Who? The nanny. Resmelda or something like that. Been with them for like the last 8 years. Does she still work for them? As far as I know. How do I get in touch with her? Ride the ferry. I put my hand up. Slow down there, cowboy. We've only just met. He blushed and stammered. I didn't mean... I know you didn't. When his face had returned to its natural color, he said, Adam has a large waterfront property on Bainbridge Island. Adam had mentioned the place. So had the Forbes article. Bainbridge Island is an island 20 miles due west of Seattle. The waterfront properties, with views of both Seattle and Mount Rainier, were rumored to go for upward of $10 million. Both Steve Allen and Howard Schultz own properties on the water. I asked, do you know the address? He hit the BlackBerry a couple times and told me the address. I thanked him, apologized for being such a jerk-off, and left. Chapter 19. The ferry station was a short 45-minute drive north. A barrage of rich businessmen, real estate developers, software moguls, and Seattle Seahawks were coming into Seattle. But I was just one of a handful going out. A single ride cost $11.85. A 20-ride card, $189.60. I opted for the former. I drove the car onto the platform, then hopped out and found the sitting area on the top deck. It was still early, before the afternoon storms, and there wasn't a touch of blue in the sky. It was chilly, probably hovering around 50, and I had traded out the blue button-down for a gray hooded sweatshirt. Six other people were scattered about, decked out in coats, scarves, the whole nine yards. I looked out of place in my sweatshirt and jeans. I caught a couple hard stares, the Seattle elite wondering why the shoddy figure before them was going to their forbidden island. One lady in a fur jacket threw me a strained look, and I mimed clipping hedges. She gave a nod as if this made perfect sense. I walked down a flight of stairs and grabbed a coffee at the small cafe. This is where most of the people congregated, and there was airport-type seating as well as five or six small TVs. One of the TVs was tuned to the news, and a red breaking news banner ran across the bottom of the screen. I assumed I knew what was coming next. They cut to footage of the courthouse steps, and a voiceover said, "Just hours ago, authorities arrested Adam Gray in connection with his wife's murder." Seconds later, the courthouse doors opened, and a handcuffed Adam Gray emerged. By his side, none other than Ethan Cates, Erica Frost, and two uniformed officers emerged. I shook my head and took a step forward. Ethan was holding one of Gray's arms. His long fingers choked Gray's biceps like five baby anacondas. He was standing tall, shoulders back, his jaw working double time on the juicy fruit lodged in his cheek. He reminded me of Kevin Costner from The Untouchables. Erica was holding the other arm. She looked almost the antithesis of Ethan, slouched, eyes down, touching Adam's elbow as if she might contract a deadly disease. As for Gray, he appeared stoic, eyes forward, head up. I imagined he would look no different being escorted to the first green at Pebble Beach. I found it a bit tacky that Ethan had decided to arrest Adam at the courthouse. Usually, with these celebrity types, they have the decency to arrange an arrest, whereby the cuffs usually stay on the belt, and the celebrity can dress dignified and say rehearsed statements. Today had been a publicity stunt. No doubt an anonymous phone call had been placed to one of the networks that something was going to happen at the courthouse around noon. The voiceover came back on. Gray was at the courthouse finalizing documents concerning the Proctor case, which had wrapped up just yesterday. Until today, he had simply been considered a person of interest in the death of his wife, Governor Ellen Gray. Reports from the Seattle Police Department indicate that he is now their prime suspect. They didn't have much else to go on but promise more during the 5 o'clock edition. They began recounting the saga, and I turned and made my way up the stairs and back to the top deck. The rest of the brave souls had called it quits, so I had the entire deck to myself. The ferry plowed through the water and a slight breeze came off the ocean. I flopped up the hood on my sweatshirt and walked to the edge of the boat. No whale tails, no shark fins, no mermaids, just miles and miles of open water. A distant landmass stood regally amid the vast blue. The island carried that gray-green color that screams pristine and untouched. At least that's what it said on the billboard. 5 to 1, there was a Starbucks somewhere on the island. 35 minutes later, we hit Bainbridge Island, and 10 minutes after that, I was pulling up to the Gray Mansion. As I approached the gated entrance, a black man in a uniform put down a magazine and stepped from the security booth. I noticed a surveillance camera pointed in my direction. I rolled down my window. The security guard asked, "Can I help you?" I whipped out a badge and said, "Todd Gregory, FBI. I'm here to see the nanny, Resmelda." The badge was legit. Agent Todd Gregory wouldn't need it where he was. He surveyed the badge for a moment before handing it back to me. He walked back to his booth and returned with a clipboard. He informed me I was not on the day's list of scheduled visitors. I said, "I don't know if you heard, but Mr. Gray was arrested this afternoon." The guy nodded. The guy signed his check. Of course he'd heard. I added, "We just have a couple more questions for Resmelda." He eyed me suspiciously, then walked back into the booth, hit something that started the gate opening, and picked his magazine back up.
So much for hired help. I pulled through the gate. The estate was marked by finely manicured gardens, densely packed with flowers that should have read their obituary 6 weeks earlier. There were two fountains, a few statues, and a bunch of other stuff that looked out of place on a private residence. As for the house, it was a behemoth. It was all angles and sharp edges. White columns supported baby blue eaves. Gray brick fed into gray shingled roofing. Off to the far right looked to be a greenhouse. To the left was a putting green and a sand trap. I assumed the stable was somewhere in the back. There was a buzzer box near the door, and I pushed the middle black square. After about a minute, the door opened. Standing in the doorway was a well-fed woman of around 50. She had dark hair held up in a bun and dark skin, looking more Spanish than Mexican. I asked, "Are you Resmelda?" She gave a slight nod.
"Sí."
"Can I ask you a couple questions?"
"Sí."
"May I come in?"
"Sí."
She seemed a bit nervous, and I said in my best Spanish, "I am Onado with O Immigration O." She brought her hand to her forehead and said in perfect English, "Thank God, they might send me back to Toronto." "El bicho." She stepped out onto the front porch and said, "Can you make this quick? I have some vacuuming I need to finish up."
"Sure thing, just a couple questions concerning Mr. Gray."
"Mr. Gray's secretary called less than an hour ago saying he was arrested."
"That's true. This is just standard follow-up. No stone left unturned and all that." She shrugged and said,
"I'll tell you what I can."
This, of course, was somewhere between "I'll tell you what I know" and "I'll tell you what will make you leave the quickest." I asked, "How often did Mr. and Mrs. Gray fight?"
She rocked her head from side to side. "Seldom, but then again, they seldom saw each other."
"Were the fights bad?"
"No worse than other married couples, I suppose."
"Anyone ever get hurt?"
She stalled, then said,
"Once."
"He beat her up?"
"All the way around."
He stifled a laugh.
"What happened?"
"They were arguing. Mrs. Gray threw a glass at him. I don't know if she meant to hit him, but she did. Hit him right in the back of the head. He had to get 6 stitches.
"Why were they fighting?"
"They were fighting over this house. Mrs. Gray had the governor's mansion at her disposal, but she only stayed there a couple nights a week. She hated taking the ferry here, then back to the city, plus a 40-minute drive. She couldn't understand why they couldn't all live in the governor's mansion like past governors. But Mr. Gray wouldn't have it. He found it proletariat, his words. But to be honest, I think Mr. Gray dreaded the commute just as much as his wife. But he'd never admit it. He sleeps at his office half the time anyway. Actually, he slept at his condo and he didn't sleep alone. I kept this to myself." I asked, "So why didn't they sell the place? There are plenty of other rich neighborhoods. Mercer Island is right there in the city." "Mercer Island isn't really an island, connected to the heart of Seattle by a half-mile-long bridge. It was even a step up from Bainbridge, if that's possible. Bill Gates had a $30 million estate somewhere on the island." She smiled and said, "The girls, they love it here. The schools are good, and the girls love riding the ferry into town. I think if it weren't for the girls, they could do without the house." From the tone of her voice, I got the impression the girls were the only thing holding the marriage together. I wondered if Resmelda knew Mrs. Gray was thinking of leaving Mr. Gray. I would get to this later. I said, "Tell me about the girls." She beamed. "Adrian is 8 and Shelley is 5. I nodded. "Poor things. Mr. and Mrs. Gray work so hard that I practically raised them myself." She paused for a moment. "They're staying with my parents in Toronto for a couple weeks. Get them away from it all."
"What about Ellen's or Adam's parents?"
"Ellen's parents still have the farm in Wisconsin. They were never close with their granddaughters. They never once came here, and Mrs. Gray only made it back there once. For Christmas, I think. and Mr. Gray's parents died when he was just a kid. He was raised by one of his aunts.
Was there ever any talk of divorce?
Not that I ever heard.
After a slight pause, I asked, "Do you think he did it?"
She went silent. After a brief couple seconds, she said, "I think deep down, Mr. and Mrs. Gray loved one another. There were times you could see it in their eyes. I think it was more the situation than anything else. Two high-profile people, high-profile jobs. They just didn't make the time."
"You didn't answer the question."
"No, I don't think he did it."
I wasn't sure if she was saying this out of loyalty, if she truly felt this way. The way she eyed her feet told me it was the former.
I said, "There's quite a bit of evidence that says otherwise."
She nodded, but said nothing.
I asked if there was a number I could reach her at in case I had any more questions, and she gave me one.
Then I said, "Well, I'll let you get back to your vacuuming. Thank you for your time."
She nodded, then receded back into the house. I started down the brick path, counted to 20, then turned and made my way back to the door. I pressed my ear against the wood and heard the faint thrum of the vacuum cleaner. I turned the door handle and pushed it inward. It opened. The noise from the vacuum cleaner was coming from somewhere on the ground floor. Your average person will vacuum from the ground up, and I hoped Resmelda was just getting started rather than wrapping things up. From what I could see, the ground floor was mostly hardwood, whereas the second and third stories would be mostly carpeted. I wasn't exactly sure what it was I was looking for. If Adam was going to hide something from his wife, he would either keep it in his office or his condo, or apparently in regards to his gun on his yacht. But that was now safely tucked away in the Seattle Police Department impound. Ellen wouldn't have it as easy. I wasn't sure what her level of privacy was in the governor's mansion, but my gut told me she would be reluctant to hide anything there. I had a feeling if she were hiding something, it would be here. I was thinking maybe photographs of Adam intertwined with another woman. Anyhow, from my experience, when you aren't looking for anything at all, you are usually apt to find something. Deep, I know. I made my way up the stairs, the thick burgundy carpet absorbing every inch of sound. There were three bedrooms and two baths on the second floor, both the girls' rooms plus a guest bedroom. I took a quick peek inside each, then continued up to the third floor. The third floor housed a second guest bedroom as well as the master bedroom. I poked my head into the guest room. It was empty. There was a sliding glass door on the far wall. I slid the door open and stepped out. The balcony looked out on the water and had a clear view of both Seattle and Mount Rainier. The view was priceless, or maybe pricey is more accurate. I scanned the water and noticed each house, it appeared, jetting out into the dark water. Docked and lapping idly against each was either a yacht or a speedboat. Some had both. The pier directly below me looked freshly stained, a dark brown that gleamed under heavy clouds. Thick white ropes lay silently on the wood. A yacht, more specifically the Habeas Corpus, had been tied up to that small pier just days before I'd pulled Ellen Gray's remains from the water. Were the two events connected? Had Ellen's body been aboard that yacht at one time or another? And if so, had Adam been at the helm? I wasn't sure anymore. I shut the balcony doors and made my way across the long hall. About halfway there, the vacuum cut out and I stopped in my tracks. Seconds later, I heard the clambering of a vacuum being lifted up the stairs. I waited for Resmelda to appear, see me, most likely have a stroke, fall down the stairs and break her neck. Or she would run and call the police, and I would end up arrested and have a breaking and entering charge added to my rap sheet. But Resmelda stopped on the second floor, and 20 seconds later the soft whir of the vacuum started back up. I took a deep breath and made my way into the master bedroom. The room looked much like you would expect of a married couple's room. Large bed, unmade, dresser for his clothes, closet for hers, couple paintings on the wall, attached bathroom with a large walk-in shower and jacuzzi tub. I rifled through a couple drawers. Adam was a whitey-tighties guy. He was reading some Grisham book and he brushed with Aquafresh. I got on my hands and knees and looked under the bed. Nada. I picked up his book, The Innocent Man, off the nightstand and read the back copy. Didn't sound half bad. Something slipped from the pages of the book and fluttered to the bed. It was a photograph, a 4x6, a shot of fall foliage, a snow-capped mountain range just off-center. It was a nice shot, good lighting, probably early morning. I shrugged. But this wasn't the only thing hidden within the book. I noticed a small bulge and flipped it open to four folded sheets of paper. I unfolded the crisp pages. The letterhead atop the first page read, "Seattle First National." It was a checking account statement. I flipped through the statement. Actually, it was two separate checking account statements. The Seattle First National statement was three pages. Then a single-page statement from a bank called Bank of Victoria. I checked the dates. Both statements were for November. I perused the First National statement first, three pages worth. According to the statement, Gray's balance was over $2 million, his liquid assets. He no doubt had millions more tied up in his portfolio, stocks, bonds, whatever was the latest trend. And if he'd gotten suspicious that his wife was divorcing him, he might have been trying to diversify even further, if you get my drift. I flipped to the back page of his transactions and read the total at the bottom. Gray had spent nearly $217,000 in the month alone. I flipped through the pages, noting some of the bigger transactions. A couple were in the low four figures. Both looked to be for furniture. He had six transactions in the $50 range to Shell Corp, so he filled up his tank about every 5 days. He had four separate mortgage payments to Allied Morgue, all totaling nearly $80,000. The biggest charge, more than $52,000, was to SUFH, which, as life goes, I knew stood for Seattle United Funeral Home. I laid the pages on the bed and picked up the Bank of Victoria statement. Gray had over $13 million in the account. There were four charges for the month of November, including a $22,000 mortgage and a $42,000 mortgage. The first charge was to the same mortgage company as the other four. I wasn't sure which place this was. The second was to a different mortgage company. This, of course, was his condo in the city. That he didn't pay for the condo in cash meant that Ellen didn't know about this particular bank account. This started me thinking, and I checked the name on the account, and surprise, surprise, there was no name. It was a numbered account. The Swiss and Caymans did it best, but the Canadians were a close third. I checked the mailing address. It was a post office box. I had a feeling not too many people knew about this account, maybe not even the IRS. The next two charges were even more intriguing. One for $17,345.22 to SPU, and another for $200,000 charged to GPI Inc. I was almost positive SPU was Gray's alma mater, Seattle Pacific University. The logical assumption was that this was a donation check. But why in the numbered account? And why such an odd amount? But I'd never given a donation before, so I wasn't sure if they took these out in installments. As for GPI Inc., I wasn't sure what the G stood for, but 90% of the time PI stood for private investigator. But most defense attorneys, especially the big hitters, have a private investigator on the payroll, so I took this with a grain of salt. I heard a soft squishing sound and froze. A moment later, a voice from the doorway said, "Hey." Chapter 20. I slowly turned my head in the direction of the voice. Resmelda had lied. The girls weren't at her parents'. The small girl had shoulder-length brown hair and was holding what looked like a Barbie doll. I surmised this would be the younger of the two, Shelley. She asked, "What you doing?" "Oh, I'm just looking around." I folded the picture up in the pages and slipped it in the front pocket of my sweatshirt. The small girl cocked her head to the side and said, "What are you looking for?" "I'm not sure. Can I help?" I ignored her question. I placed the book back on the dresser, walked to her, and got down on my haunches. Shelley had her mother's big brown eyes, but that was all. She had her father's nose and lips. She was at that age where everything still looked perfect, a doll herself. As for the doll she was holding, it was one of those 80s Barbies, punk Barbie or something. Hair back in a ponytail, the token headband, tights, jean jacket, collar up, and neon armbands. Reminded me of a girl I dated in high school. I asked, "What's her name?" She looked at the doll and said, "Deirdre? That's a pretty name." "What's your name?" "Shelley." "That's even prettier." "I'm Thomas." She repeated, "Thomas." "How old are you, Shelley?" She clamped the doll to her chest with her elbow, so her hands were free, and made a five with her left hand. Then she asked, "How old are you?" I made my fingers into an eight. Shelley opened her mouth wide and exclaimed, That's old.
You're telling me.
Do you go to school?
I'm in kindergarten.
Yeah?
She nodded.
She peeked around my shoulder and said, "This is Mommy and Daddy's room."
Is it?
Mommy's in heaven.
I didn't know how to respond to this, so I kept quiet.
Shelley asked, "Are you looking for the bad man?"
I hope this wasn't her nickname for Daddy. Who is the bad man?
He yelled at Mommy.
The bad man yelled at Mommy?
I skipped the day they taught how to question a 5-year-old, but I remembered something about repeating their statements.
She nodded 3 times, slowly, the way kids do.
I asked, "Where did the bad man yell at Mommy?"
"By the fish."
By the fish? That can mean just about anywhere in Seattle.
What fish are you talking about?
They throw them.
She threw her doll in the air about 6 inches, then caught it, cradling it back to her chest.
They throw the fish.
Then it hit me. In the heart of Seattle is a glorified flea market. Glorified because, unlike a real flea market, things are not cheap and rarely negotiable. About a mile long. Basically, Pike Place Market is a throng of shops selling anything and everything. Flowers, fruit, jewelry, shirts, belts, honey, carvings, paintings, salt and pepper shakers, knitted caps, I Love Seattle gear, and everything in between. The most renowned of all the shops is the Pike's Place Fish Company. Whenever there's an order, they throw the fish about 40 feet, then chop its head off to the delight of the onlookers. I asked, "Do you mean Pike Market?" She nodded.
"What did the bad man say?"
She shook her head.
"You don't remember?"
She shook her head again.
"But the man was yelling at her." She nodded.
"What did he look like?" She shrugged.
"Was he older than me?"
She shrugged again.
"Great time to get shy, kid."
She cocked her head to the side, and I knew she'd remembered something.
She said, "He had a red face."
I wasn't exactly sure what this meant.
Did the guy have his face painted?
I'd been to Pike a handful of times, and they always had a booth where the kids could paint their faces.
I asked, "He had red paint on his face?"
She shook her head. "No paint."
"Was he an Indian?"
Sorry, but all political correctness gets thrown out when you're dealing with a 5-year-old. Plus, there were at least a dozen Native American shops at Pike.
Shelley thought this was funny and said, "Like Squanto?"
She'd probably just finished learning about the first Thanksgiving in kindergarten.
"Yeah, like Squanto."
She shook her head, a smile clinging to the edges of her small mouth.
Shucks. That would have narrowed down the suspect pool.
Excuse me, I'm looking for Chief Redface.
I asked, "Do you remember anything else?"
She thought for a moment, then said, "He had a big sign."
I thought about this.
This could mean one of 2 things. Either he had a booth at Pike, or he was picketing. But more importantly, this meant that he might make a habit of hanging out down there.
"Do you know what the sign said?"
"I can't read yet," she added,
"but I know the alphabet."
"Do you?"
She proved that she did indeed know the alphabet.
I'd already pushed my luck on time and said my goodbyes to Shelley. She insisted I say bye to Deirdre, and I was happy to oblige. I was on my way down the hall when I heard footsteps pitter-pattering behind me. I turned. Shelley was standing behind me. She said, "He had a doggy." The vacuum cut out. I stood still. A door opened, and Rosmelda yelled, "Shelley, honey, who are you talking to?" I put my finger up to my mouth and pointed to her doll. She smiled and said, "Deirdre." Rosmelda laughed and said, "Okay, sweetie." The door closed, and the vacuum started back up. I took a deep breath. I whispered, "Who had a doggy?"
"The bad man."
"What did the doggy look like?"
She said he was big and white and that he was a scary doggy.
I asked her a couple more questions, but she went back to the shrugs.
I said, "Can you keep a secret?"
She nodded.
"Don't tell anybody about me, okay? Our little secret."
She nodded. I made her cross her heart. She did. She made me say goodbye to Deirdre again, and then I quickly descended the stairs. I could see the cord from the vacuum slithering under one of the girls' bedroom doors. I vaulted down the steps and silently slid out the front door. I ran down the cobbled path and exited through a side gate, then hightailed it to my car. For all I knew, Shelley had already spilled the beans, and the police were on their way. I made it to my car, pulled a U-turn, and drove to the security booth. I was rehearsing the lines I was going to feed to the security guard, but to my delight, the gate swung open automatically.
Once I'd made it down a couple blocks, I allowed myself a few calming breaths. On my third exhale, a black Jaguar, with darkly tinted windows, screeched through a stop sign and zoomed past me. I watched in my rearview mirror as the black blur turned left onto Gray's block. The car's license plate read, NTGLTY, not guilty. Adam Gray had made bail, and a killer was on the loose.
Chapter 21.
G-47.
I looked down at my card. G-50, G-48, G-46, G-59, G-53, no G-47.
I glanced to my left and watched Harold. He was hovering an inch over his card, slowly moving his head down the column. I couldn't help but notice he was hovering over column B. At this point, it might be better just to be completely blind. Anyhow, I noticed he had G-47 on his board. I took my stamper and stamped it for him, covering the number in an inky green. He looked at me and said,
"I thought," she said, "B-411.
I didn't have the heart to tell him this wasn't possible. We'd been playing bingo for over an hour and no one had won. I think it was a combination of the 20 people playing being either deaf or blind, the lady yelling out the bingo numbers having been a recent recipient of a tracheotomy and using one of those electronic vibration thingies, making her sound like RoboCop, and two-thirds of the participants being either asleep or dead. I'd first gotten bingo an hour ago. My entire sheet had been blacked out for the last 30 minutes. I should also add that I was starving and cranky. I leaned into Harold and whispered into his Cinnabon-sized ear, "When is the game over?"
"What game?"
"Right." I asked, "You hungry?" He nodded. "Thank God." We made our way to the cafeteria and ate the same things we had eaten and talked about the same things we had talked about on my last visit. Near the end of our meal, like before, the waitress dropped off two slices of white bread wrapped in cellophane. And like before, 20 minutes later, we were sitting on the bench, tossing small pieces of bread into the still lake. The bread would land softly on the glass water, tiny rivulets spreading outward from it, small foothills on a desolate blue. The ducks never came, gone south for the winter. I looked at the old form taking the deep inhales from the oxygen tank beside me. I think a part of him knew he would never see the ducks again. He took a deep breath, the oxygen tank letting out a light puff, and said,
"War. It's terrible."
Harold's first weeks at Fort Bragg were miserable. He'd had little interaction with other men his age, and he found himself uncomfortable in his new surroundings. He didn't mind the commanders, the yelling, or any of the physical hardships. In fact, he quickly rose to the top of his class. He learned early on he was a great deal stronger than his peers, and faster and smarter, the very reasons many of his fellow infantry mates despised him. 6 weeks in, and one of the larger kids, a bully type everyone called Harker, knocked Harold's tray over in the mess hall. The meek Harold quickly grabbed a broom and cleaned up the spill, apologizing for whatever he'd done. He was jeered for his cowardly act. They called him everything from yellow farmer boy to the cowardly lion. Harold began to doubt his resolve. If he couldn't stick up to a kid his own age, how could he be expected to kill another soldier in battle? A week later, a similar confrontation occurred. He was returning his tray when he felt two hands on his back. The violent shove sent him reeling, sending the contents of his tray into a group of five soldiers eating nearby. The five jumped to their feet, and Harold was soon outnumbered 6-1. He brushed himself off, trying to stop the tears in their tracks. He failed. Tears began to drip from his cheeks. The hulking Harker stepped forward and slapped him across the face. For that split second, Harold was back on the king's doorstep. He could see the precious Elizabeth watching him. In fact, it was as if she was watching him that very second. Harker and two other boys spent the next 5 weeks in the infirmary. I shook my head. "You kicked the shit out of all of them?"
"Just three of them. After I kicked in Harker's knee, I smashed two guys' heads together. The other three ran away before I could get to them."
I looked at Harold Rambo and let out a laugh. "I bet no one ever messed with you again."
"No, no, they didn't."
Harold's unit was Company E, 16th Infantry, 1st Infantry Division. Harold had quickly moved up the ranks to lieutenant. On June 6, 1944, Harold and his fellow troops stormed Omaha Beach, facing the recently formed German 352nd Infantry Division. He had become close friends with many of his soldiers, but he was closest with one named Thad, whom, incidentally, Harold had put in the infirmary just a little over a year earlier. The two had watched as half their regiment was either killed or badly wounded in three separate battles preceding D-Day, but nothing could have prepared them for the onslaught they would see this day. 50,000 Americans stormed Omaha Beach on D-Day. 5,000 of them would never return. Thad would be one of those 5,000. While sitting in hiding not more than 7 feet from his best friend and commander, Thad had taken a piece of shrapnel in his side. His good friend had held his entrails in his hands as he took his final breaths. I let out a long breath and said, "Fuck." Harold nodded, "Yeah, fuck." Harold didn't eat for a week, then two. He relinquished his position as lieutenant. He became even more reserved. He wondered how he could possibly get through another year and a half of watching people die, watching his friends die. Harold was moved into Poland to do patrol, one of the safer positions at the time. Neither he nor the U.S. Army believed Harold Humphreys was still capable of pulling a trigger. Harold vowed he would never take another life, unless it was his own. It was a Tuesday in August of his third year. He had less than 9 months left in his enlistment. The soldier in charge of mail delivery came into his barracks and began dropping letters and packages on people's beds. In his 2.5 years, Harold had received 3 letters from his parents and 3 letters from each sister. Normally, Harold received the letters 8 or 10 weeks after they'd been postmarked. So when the soldier stopped in front of Harold's bed and dropped off a thick stack of letters, Harold was more than taken aback. He unbound the letters and stared at the top one. It had Harold Humphreys, U.S. Army, scrawled in tight cursive. He opened the letter and read it. It was from the young girl, Elizabeth. My cheeks hurt from smiling. I said, "She wrote you a letter?"
"She wrote me 129 letters.
129?
One a week for 2.5 years.
What did she say?
He patted my leg and said,
"Everything. She said everything."
Harold read the letters every day for a month, all 129 letters, every day for a month. Then he finally wrote her back, poured his heart out, told her a day hadn't gone by that he hadn't thought about her, that he wanted to come back to marry her, that he loved her. The delivery soldier walked by his bed for 8 weeks, 8 weeks without stopping. Then the 9th week he stopped. Harold's heart leapt. He picked up the letter, but he couldn't bear to read it. What if she didn't feel the same way? He kept the letter for a week before reading it. Then he did, with tears running down his cheeks. She felt the same way. She desperately wanted to marry him. She couldn't think of anything that would make her happier. Harold kept the letter in his pocket while he did his patrols, slept with it under his pillow. He read it every day, sometimes twice. It became his mantra, his reason for living. He could utter every word under his breath like a favorite poem. Harold paused for a brief moment. Then he slowly began hiking up his right pant leg, exposing a grotesquely white leg. Blue, black, purple, and red veins spiderwebbed across the pasty flesh. A black sock was pulled taut halfway up his calf. There was a small bulge atop. Harold reached his arm down, slid his fingers into his sock, and pulled out a folded piece of paper. The paper appeared soft and supple. Reopened and refolded so many times, the fibers had broken down. It had streaks of brown running across it. Harold unfolded the letter, and I watched as his large eyes pulled in every word. About halfway through, he took 2 quick inhales through his nose, something I'd yet to see him do. I felt like I was watching, seeing something I knew I shouldn't be, like when you accidentally flipped to something in the 660s on television. Harold finished the letter, the folds practically doing themselves, and stuffed it back in his sock. He gave it 2 quick pats, then released the bunched fabric of his pant leg. He gazed across the still lake, hands clasped together on his lap. I watched as he slowly moved his hand from his lap and laid it silently on the bench just to my left. I stared at the long fingers, bony and brittle. I imagine those fingers working the fields for hours and hours. Those fingers wrapped around the butt of a gun. Those fingers slinking around a pen and moving briskly across the page. Truly, those fingers had been through war.
I reached out my left hand and slid it beneath the cold fingers. They slowly awakened, intertwining between mine.
We held hands like that for a while, waiting for the ducks to return.
Chapter 22. Within a square mile was the Seattle Convention and Visitor Center, Westlake Shopping Center, the Seattle Symphonies, Benaroya Hall, the Seattle Art Museum and Pacific Science Center, Waterfront Shopping along Elliott Bay, Safeco Field and the Seahawks Quest Field. Yet the Pike Place Market remained the number one tourist attraction in the state of Washington. I'd come to Pike for two reasons. One, Christmas was less than 2 weeks away, and I'd yet to buy Lacey a present. I'd never sent anything overseas, but I imagined I wouldn't be able to overnight it as per my usual method. Second, Shelley's bad man might be in attendance. I wasn't overly optimistic, but it was one of those rare Seattle sunny days. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, and I had a feeling people would be out in record numbers. The place was a zoo, and I use the word zoo both literally and figuratively. Seriously, some of these people belonged in cages. I'm not talking about the bums and the beggars who were ever present. I'm talking about the street performers. Seattle was a hub of culture, art, music, and dance, and the street performers came in hordes. In just the first block alone, I encountered about 10 street performers. Let's see, there was disco dancing guy, mannequin guy, multiple instrument guy, piano playing bum, old Chinese guy with string bow type instrument, hippie band with one too many sleeping dogs, blind musician guy, and countless others vying for your shiny quarter or crumpled George Washington. My first objective was this Polish pastry joint. The line was out the door, but I remembered it moved fast, and I hopped in back. I ordered an apple cinnamon roll. They had a special name for it, of course, probably an 8-letter word with no vowels like PLZTKJVC, then moved on to Coffee Shop Alley. There were about 20 coffee shops, including both the first Starbucks and the first Seattle's Best. I chose Starbucks because I am loyal and they need the money. Plus, they had the pumpkin spice latte, which in 2 months, when it was discontinued, would land me in rehab. I sipped the beautiful drink and made my way over to watch the piano-playing bum. About 60 people huddled in a half moon around the man and his dwarf piano. The guy was unkempt and probably hadn't showered in a week, but he was simply amazing. Beethoven meets Gary Busey. He was the one guy who always had a thick crowd and his tip jar was always full. He had long white hair flowing from beneath a knitted cap, a ragged green army jacket, and knitted gloves. The fingertips had been cut off the gloves, and you could see his fingers flittering away. On the side of his piano, he advertised his CD was only $19.95, and he did private parties. Good to know. I listened to him play 2 songs, then stuffed a $5 bill in his tip jar. Saturday was always the busiest day at Pike, at least for the picketers. They congregated nearest the north entrance, where a huge park was nestled up on the water. 6 or 7 different groups congregated on the grassy knoll leading into the market. Some were picketing the war, for and against, some the current traffic problems, some for candidates that I'd never heard of, for positions I'd never heard of, and even one that was picketing. I read a handful of the various signs. Bush wants your son dead. Let's invade Canada. Make I-5 19 lanes, both directions. Vote Balski, second vice treasurer. And no more picketing at Pike. Maybe there was an irony convention in town. Anyhow, I didn't come by a red-faced man with a pooch, so I decided to take my chances with the booth owners. Nobody caught my eye in the front half of the market, but I did start and finish my Christmas shopping. I bought Lacey some earrings, a cool bracelet, and a couple pieces of local art she would love. About the midpoint of the market is the Pike Place Fish Company. Thousands of pounds of fish were displayed behind thick glass, as well as 100 feet of shelved ice, covered in every fish imaginable. I read some of the handwritten signs. Fancy Alaskan king crab. We pack fish for travel. Local live mussels. Fresh catfish.
We deliver to 11 downtown hotels for free. Wild Troll King Salmon is finally here, and various others. One section was littered with enormous fish. Giant salmon, marlin, swordfish. I guess some of these weighed upward of 60 pounds. About 100 people waited around the wraparound for the four employees, decked out in bright orange jumpers to start throwing fish. A timid young woman stepped forward from the crowd. She looked like one of those shy kids who steps in front of the microphone at the National Spelling Bee and asked for a particular kind of fish. The four orange-clad men yelled in unison, "Fish in!" One man went around the ice and grabbed an enormous fish about 3 feet long and heaved it into the air. The crowd oohed and aahed at every toss until the prize fish's head was chopped off and it was neatly packaged. The woman paid for the fish and returned to the sanctity of the crowd. I watched the ruckus for 20 minutes, then started the second leg. I perused for another 2 hours, making my way down to the far south end. I was watching a young man airbrush a hat when I noticed a man a couple booths down, or I noticed the big dog perched in front of his booth. I made my way over. The dog was big and white, a husky. He had those light blue husky eyes. I'm not sure if the dog had a metabolism problem or if his diet consisted entirely of honey and jam, as the two empty jars beside him would indicate. But he was like the Jabba the Hutt of dogs. He didn't seem all that scary, and I gave him a rub behind the ears. As for the booth owner, he was more or less a kid, maybe 18, maybe 20. He had dark brown hair and a generous amount of raw acne, which gave his face a red cast. Worth a try. He was working a booth that sold honeys and jams. The young man was just finishing up with an older woman with a cane, packing her many jars into a box. I sidled up to the table, set the bag holding Lacey's gifts on the ground, and leaned the two paintings I was lugging against the table legs. A bunch of samples were laid out, and I picked a straw of honey, which turned out to be peach, and sucked it down. It was heavenly. The kid wrapped up the transaction with the woman and turned to me. On closer inspection, the kid's face was a mess, like one of those before pictures on the proactive infomercials. He smiled and said, "What do you think?" I thought about telling this kid he needed to invest in some tetracycline honey, but I still had the straw in my mouth and garbled, "Tastes like honey." The kid found this amusing, then said, "Yeah, the peach is one of our best sellers." I cocked my head to the side and asked, "That your dog?" "Yep, Larry." I looked down, but Larry had moved to the center of the walkway and appeared to be licking up the remnants of a dropped waffle cone. Yeah, that's just what he needed. I turned back around. The kid was fishing under the table. He emerged with a honey stick from some secret supply and said, "Give this one a try." I took the straw from him and squeezed it into my mouth. It was hard to describe, tart but delicious. I gave him a slight nod and he said, "Pomegranate." He had me taste several of his other flavors, all the while rambling about the quality of his honey, its origins, why it was better than the competition, and so on and so forth. Then he went for the kill. "So how about we do one of each?" The kid was good. I'd forgotten why I'd stumbled to his booth in the first place. I said, "Sure." He was packaging up my items when I said, "I have a couple questions for you," I added, "and they aren't about honey." I should mention that at this point I had my badge out and dangling in front of me. Pimply Face's eyes registered the badge and his jaw literally dropped. His Adam's apple went up twice and I thought he might actually throw it up. Two actions that rank extremely high in my list of suspicious behaviors. Pimply Face went back to packing up my order, then in one quick movement, lurched in my direction. I didn't have time to react, the entire contents of a jar of honey blasting me in the face. For the record, it was the peach. I'm not going to go into the particulars of honey and its structure, but it's heavy and it's sticky. I had honey in my hair, my nose, my eyes, my ears, my mouth, honey all over my chest, huge globs of it dripping off my chin and into my shirt. I was not a happy camper. I did a quick swipe of my face and turned on my heel. My vision was a bit blurry on account of the honey glaze on my contacts, but I could still make out the back of the kid's head as he darted through the crowd. I figured he had a 10-step head start. I tore through the crowd, screaming for people to get out of my way. Most people did. I turned a corner and smashed into a man strumming a guitar. I had just enough time to see that he was wearing dark sunglasses and a top hat. I struck the man hard, and we both tumbled to the ground in a heap. I fell on the man's guitar case and pushed myself up. I said, "Sorry, I told you to watch out." The man said, "I'm blind."
"Right. I guess watching out wouldn't be his strong suit."
I turned. The kid was now about 10 booths ahead of me, screeching around a large booth filled with flowers. I resumed the chase. At some point, I noticed something clinging to my chest. I glanced down. There were 5 or 6 quarters, 3 $1 bills, and 1 $10 bill sticking to my honey-drenched sweatshirt. The blind guy must not be half bad. I made it to the flower booth. It was one of the longer booths, covered with bright bouquets. People were backed up 4 deep, sniffing and poking at the flowers. I needed to make up some ground on the kid, and before I knew what I was doing, I'd leapt onto the closest table. The table wobbled but held. There were 4 Asian women working the booth, and they all began screaming. One of the women grabbed a broom and swung it at me as I darted across the long booth. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Many a plant died that day. I hopped off the platform, pulled the 1425 off my sweatshirt, and plopped it on the counter. Karma and all. A second round of screaming ensued, and I peered down the length of the table. At first, I thought it was a polar bear. It wasn't. It was Larry. He had decided to join the chase and had somehow jumped up onto the wobbly tables. I watched rapt as Larry slowly, methodically, knocked over or ate every flower in sight. Had I not been in the midst of a chase, I imagine I would have been rolling around on the ground in hysterics. But back to the chase. Less than 20 yards behind me, there was a stairwell, and I figured the kid probably went down. I took the stairs 4 at a time. When I reached the bottom, I could make out Pimply Face going up the stairs at the opposite end. A couple dozen people were waiting in line for the restrooms, but for the most part, the corridor was barren. I sprinted the stretch and vaulted up the stairs and into the sunlight. I could see the kid huffing and puffing in the middle of the street. His eyes bugged out when he saw me and he took off. He bolted left, crashing through a booth selling an assortment of multicolored peppermills. The kid ran through the back of the booth, knocking over a beam in the process, and the entire booth came crashing down. It was a good move. The kid put some distance between the two of us. I ran around the booth and entered into a densely packed walkway. We were nearing the Pike Place Fish Company, where the crowd had quadrupled in the last hour. I could see the kid weaving his way through the people. I decided to make up some ground and darted behind the ice shelving to where the men in orange jumpers were standing, thinking if I could cut through the back, I would come out before the kid, then just wait for him to emerge. At least that's how I figured it in my head. I heard the first ooh, then a loud ah. I never saw the fish coming. It hit me hard in the chest. It felt like a truck. Apparently, someone had ordered a sperm whale. I lay flat on my back, eyes closed, gasping for a breath that would never come. The last thing I remember was the sensation of a tongue running down the length of my face. Larry. Then I blacked out.
Chapter 23. I looked up at the doctor. He was all white. White hair, white mustache, white coat, white face. His name was also White, Dr. White. Dr. White was holding something black. On closer inspection, it appeared to be X-ray film. He shook his head from side to side. I hate it when they do that. He said, "It looks like you've suffered a collapsed lung, Mr. Prescott." I readjusted myself on the bed, a blinding pain shooting through my chest, and managed, "Is that bad?" "It isn't good," he added. "We actually thought you'd suffered a heart attack until we looked at the X-rays. You were reaching oxygen levels in the 98th percentile with your right lung alone." To my knowledge, I'd never reached the 98th percentile in anything in my life. "Can you call my 10th grade trigonometry teacher and tell her that?" He threw me a half smile, probably his 30th of the day. He turned and said, "Well, what we're going to have to do is pump up that left lung of yours." Sounded easy enough. "It will take about 24 hours, and I'd be lying if I said it was pleasant." Not exactly the words a patient longs for, but I guess it's better than "it's malignant" or "it's going to have to come off" or "I hope you didn't buy any green bananas." He explained what exactly would be taking place, and he was right, it didn't sound pleasant. They would make a small incision just under my armpit and insert a hose. The hose would vacuum out all the air surrounding the outside of my lung. In a sense, they were sucking my lung back open. The doctor walked to the doorway, then turned and said,
A nurse will be in shortly to get things started. 27 minutes later, there was a knock at the door and Patty walked into my life. How would one describe Patty without invoking the gag reflex? I think she might have been a patient and won some be-a-nurse-for-a-day sweepstakes. She had two moles, one on her forehead and one just under her chin. Now, let me tell you about these two moles. First off, they had a combined surface area of a tennis ball. Second, these two moles could have been the after picture on a hair club for men infomercial. And third, they jiggled, like jello molds. If Patty wasn't scary enough, she was pushing this huge machine. Using my uncanny detective abilities, I deduced that this was the machine I would soon be attached to, ergo, it was the machine which would suck my lung open. Seriously, get Wes Craven on the phone. Patty slipped this little thing on my finger. She called it a pulse oximeter that monitored my oxygen levels. She was putting an IV in my arm when it happened. I'm fine with needles. Stick one in my eye, if you please, but I was not fine with the proximity of Patty's mole. As she was leaning down to insert the needle, Patty's mole danced in the breeze like a Sugar Ray Leonard punching bag. Just as she found my vein, Mr. Mole brushed my shoulder. My arm flew up, Patty screamed, and I gagged, all within a nanosecond of one another. Patty covered her face and ran from the room. I was confused until I looked at my finger. There, on the plastic contraption on my left pointer finger, was Patty's mole. I may have screamed. Two nurses barged through the door and asked what was wrong. I told them. One of them turned white. The other picked the contraption off the floor, 30 feet away where I'd thrown it, and outfitted me with a fresh one. The doc came in 20 minutes later. He asked if I wanted to be put to sleep or if I wanted a local anesthesia. I told him to run the operation by me a second time. He said the surgery was simple enough. He would make a small incision under my armpit, insert a chest tube into my pleural cavity, and the chest tube would be attached to the suction device, which I would be hooked up to for the foreseeable future. Anesthesia, please. I woke up 2 hours later in a fog. The sterile post-op room slowly came into focus, as did the small child in the bed directly opposite mine. Apparently, I'd booked a double, and here I thought I was getting a suite. Looking back on it, I'm fairly certain Patty was responsible for this decision. I must have ripped off her favorite mole.
I did her a favor, if you ask me. A dermatologist would have charged $100 to lance that atrocity. If he charged by the ounce, it would have been twice that.
The kid's name was Danny. Danny was 12. Danny had just had his tonsils removed. Because Danny couldn't talk, Danny had a big pad and Danny would write messages on his big pad and Danny would wave his big pad at Thomas until Thomas read it. This is how Thomas would learn all the aforementioned data about Danny. Thomas would also learn that Danny liked to play basketball and draw and fish and annoy the hell out of Thomas. After about an hour of this, young Danny picked up some little video game thingy and started playing it. Thank God. I watched the clock for 20 minutes, then I watched my heartbeat for 20 minutes. Funny thing is, when Danny was annoying the shit out of me, the time went considerably faster. I asked, "What is that thing?" He put the game down, scribbled on his pad, and held it up. It read, "Nintendo DS." I'd never heard of it. "What game are you playing?" He wrote some game I'd never heard of. I asked, "Do you have Tetris?" He nodded. Then he wrote, "Do you want to play it?" Oh, sweet, sweet Danny. Danny walked the thing over, and with a bunch of jostling and cajoling, he showed me how to play it. Needless to say, they'd made drastic improvements since the days of the Game Boy. Danny watched me play a game, then retired back to his bed. I was just getting the hang of things when I noticed Danny's pad being waved in my peripheral. I looked up. Written on his pad was, "Can I have it back now?" I smiled and said, 10 more minutes. He wrote ferociously, then held his pad up again. It read, "That's what you said 2 hours ago." Actually, it was 3 hours ago. I smiled at him and punched the button on the side of my bed. 30 seconds later, a nurse came bursting through the door. She ran to my bed and said, "Is everything okay? You tripped your panic button." "I'm fine, but he won't stop screaming." I pointed at young Danny. She looked at Danny. She did the poor baby head shake, then proceeded to pull a syringe from her waist and stick it into Danny's IV. Danny looked confused. I smiled at him and waved. "Night-night, Danny." 3 minutes later, he was out cold. I played the video game until it ran out of batteries. I tossed it to Danny, and it landed on his chest with a thud. He didn't budge. Still out. Speaking of which, the medicine they'd given me was wearing off, and I called the nurse for another dose. She obliged, and a couple minutes later, I too was in a narcotic-induced slumber. I woke up a couple hours later in a groggy stupor. I sat up. Danny was awake and had a message waiting for me. Rise and shine, sleepyhead. I looked for something to throw at him, but everything in reach was bolted down. 30 seconds later, Danny had a new message. Grumpy. Paging Dr. Grumpy. I closed my eyes and mentally shoved Danny's pen and pad down his throat. When I opened my eyes, a lady was standing in the doorway, and it wasn't Patty. I glanced at the heart rate monitor. Luckily, it was facing away from the woman in the doorway's field of vision. The red numbers jumped from 63 to 83 to 97 to 106 to 118. Not a good sign. I said, "Are you here for your measles, mumps, and rubella shot, too?" Erica smiled and said, "Got mine last year." She took a couple steps toward my bed. For the record, she was wearing blue jeans and a tan jacket. She had a pink hat pulled down low on her forehead, not to mention she looked like she smelled good, if that makes any sense. I glanced at the heart rate monitor. 115, 127, 135. Erica plopped down in the chair nearest my bed and grabbed my hand. She smiled and said, "How you feeling?" She was directly underneath the heart rate monitor, which was now reading 161 in big red numbers. If I didn't get my heart rate under control here in the next couple seconds, three nurses were going to come crashing through the door. I slipped my hand from hers and said, "Like Brett Favre on Monday." She flashed an uncomfortable smile. At my slipping my hand away or my dumb joke, she didn't specify. I asked, "How did you know I was here?" "I have my ways." I raised an eyebrow. She said, "I heard Honey was involved." She must have read the police report. I nodded, "Peach. They ended up catching the kid, you know." She paused, then added, "How did you know?" "How did I know what?" "About a secret stash?" "The pomegranate? You let me sample it. Tastes a little like a mango wrapped in seaweed." "I'm talking about the other stash." I tried to sit up. "Drugs?" "Yeah. He had a couple boxes of honey that was infused with methamphetamines." "Meth honey. No wonder he freaked when I showed him my badge." Erica studied me for a second, then said, "If you didn't know about the drugs, then why were you chasing him?" She stood up. "Please tell me this doesn't have anything to do with Ellen Gray." I put up my hand. "Settle down there. Now, who is this Ellen Gray you speak of?" She shook her head from side to side, like she had Parkinson's. She looked like she belonged on the 8th floor. She stammered, "I thought you said you weren't going to get involved." "I'm not involved. I'm sitting in a hospital bed with a big tube in my side, getting my lungs sucked open." She sat back down. "But for the sake of argument, why don't you tell me how the case is progressing?" "You promise you won't get involved?" "Scout's honor." I failed to mention the closest I'd ever been to a scout was playing Stratego. She took a deep breath. "As you know, we arrested him last Thursday. He spent a total of 45 minutes behind bars. This guy has connections like you wouldn't believe. People are scared of him. Cops don't want to go near him. Judges are ducking and covering like a field full of prairie dogs. I've never seen anything like it. Anyhow, a grand jury is convening starting Monday. They'll decide if there's enough evidence against him to mandate a trial." "And?"
"And what?
And is there?"
"An overwhelming amount."
I laughed. This was inconvenient, and I nearly threw up from the pain that coursed through my chest. Erica patted my arm and asked, "You okay?" Her touch was electric. The pain shooting through my chest was the last thing on my mind. I took a deep breath and said, "Yeah, I'm all right." What I wanted to say was, "Come on, kid, get a clue. Why would Adam Gray, a man who reached the pinnacle of his profession by making a habit of not making mistakes, any, ever, leave a trail of cookie crumbs? It was an obvious setup. Such an obvious setup that I was starting to think that Adam Gray had set up his own setup. But again, he was too smart. Lawyers are the experts of persuasion and mind-molding, and they do it without the jury knowing. Adam Gray was a master of manipulation. That's what made him the best. If Adam Gray had committed this murder, Ellen Gray's body would never have been found. This I knew for certain." I stared into Erica's deep hazel eyes. She had these tiny little green flecks, like little chunks of ivy growing from her perfect pupil. There was an intelligence in those eyes. The same intelligence I saw on the back of a spoon. She'd get to the truth eventually. I just hoped it was before I caused myself any more bodily harm. There was a knock at the door, and Patty popped in her head, or popped in her mole, if you want to get technical. She said, "Visiting hours are over." I scratched my chin and said, "Thanks, Patty." She didn't find this humorous and disappeared. Erica stood up, gave my hand a final squeeze, and said, "See you around, Mr. Prescott.
See you around, Miss Frost."
She walked from the room, giving me a quick glance and a smile, then slipped through the doorway. I took a calming breath and laid my head back. I could see Danny waving his stupid pad at me, and I read what he'd written. I smirked. "Yeah, kid, I did."